We do have a ton to get through in this episode.
Common sense is finally prevailing.
There was controversy this month, Dave.
I'm not particularly excited by that.
Secrets and things on set.
I haven't told them anything.
I think this is just good times all round.
Every Doctor Who is liked by somebody, and that's a really good thing.
Dave-o, my Doctor.
I know we disagree on this one.
First world problems, Dave.
I get why fans are asking those questions.
Oh gosh, that's actually quite a lot to talk about.
Doesn't compute.
It's the elephant in the room.
That's okay.
Fandom versus the BBC.
The cardinal sin.
Moving along.
Lunch. Hello and welcome to the Doctor Who Show. I'm Dave.
And I'm Rob.
And this is our flagship episode for March 2024, where Rob, we are the Time Meddlers.
We are. We are. It sounds like a synth pop group.
Absolutely. This started. That would be a terrible synth pop group. This started life as an alternate histories concept. I've spoken about this is us treading on butterflies and changing the timeline. But we are going to look at some moments in Doctor Who history and change something there, turn the course of the show's history, and just speculate about how that might have changed the timelines, how that might have changed the future. We don't know what each other has picked. We just know what years we've picked. Items to change in from, so it's going to be a big surprise. Rob, how are you?
I'm very well, Dave, and I'll just say when we put together that list of, you know, what years have you got, we seem to have coordinated this very well, psychically.
Yes, it's almost perfectly going back and forth between us. There are a couple where our years are about the same, so I'm wondering if we've snapped, but if we have, I'm sure we're taking the timelines in very different directions and we'll have different takes, so that's going to be interesting. This is exciting.
It is. It is. I've been looking forward to this all month, to be perfectly honest.
Absolutely. And look, it's a very quick turnaround for us. We're recording the day before broadcast, which is unusual for us.
Yes.
Mostly because I've been away in Canberra doing sort of 14-hour days for the last week, and Doctor Who podcast didn't get much of a look in. And then I was at the footy last night. Carlton smashed North Melbourne. Hello,
yeah,
Richard. Hello,
game.
Rob. So a very good game. So look, I'm in a good mood. I'm excited. But before we get to our main topic, we've got lots of other stuff to cover, including some proper news. But we've also got an Apple Podcast review, Rob.
Yes, we love when we get Apple Podcast reviews and we put them up at the start of each show when we get them. This is from Seagull68 on Apple Podcasts, and it was left on the 24th of February. The headline is Highly Recommended, 5 stars. Easily the best Doctor Who podcast out there. Informative, detailed and varied shows which are perfectly timed, never too long, never too short. Differences of opinion are respected, even if disagreed with, just like the good old days. Rob and Dave, splendid chaps, both of them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Seagull. That's a lovely review. The pressure is on us now to keep to time this episode as well.
Yes.
But thank you very much for the review. It's always nice to hear that people enjoy what we do.
Love it.
Now, I'll kick us into the news because we've had a couple of big items drop this month, and probably the biggest is we now have a launch date for the new season of Doctor Who, Shooty Gatwa's first proper series as the Doctor. And there's a couple of things to unpack here because we've got not just the fact of the date, but how it's been done, but also a bit of a discussion about how this was dropped, which was quite controversial. Rob, we know that Doctor Who is starting on the 11th of May, but it's going to be a global drop. It will be dropping at midnight in the UK. That's episodes 1 and 2, and then presumably an episode a week after that, which is 7 p.m. on a Friday in New York, 9 a.m. on the east coast of Australia on the Saturday. So the whole world, Rob, is going to get Doctor Who in one fell swoop on various different streaming platforms. Well, I say various, but it's either BBC iPlayer or Disney Plus for the rest of the world. There will still be a free-to-air broadcast of the show on Saturday evening, as usual. But fans, if they wish to in the UK, can get up at midnight. In Australia, it's kind of about what we're used to. It's, if anything, a little bit later. It's going to be a bit more convenient. 9 a.m. Saturday, we can get up and watch the show. The US gets it Friday evening. Rob, before we get into how this was done, what do you think of that part?
Well, I don't understand why they're going down that path, to be quite honest. I think the path they followed with the 60th anniversary specials was the right path, whereby the go live was dictated by when is the show going out on the BBC, on terrestrial television. And then once it's out there, it can go live around the rest of the world. And that meant for the US folks, it was there for them earlier in the afternoon on the same day on the East Coast, and even earlier again on the West Coast. For us in ANZ, we'd wake up on our Sunday morning and there it was, ready to go, same as we've had it for years now. All good. I think everyone was satisfied by that, even us here. And we were the most hard done by that sort of timing. It felt okay. Why didn't they just repeat that? This shift to midnight for the UK, I find quite bizarre in some ways, and I don't really see the upside to it. I mean, can anyone out there, let alone you, Dave, tell me a time zone that really wins, in quotation mark, wins from this change?
I would say that the US wins. I think that getting it on a Friday evening at sort of prime time in the US is definitely a good thing for them. And that is, I think, is what's driving this from a Disney Plus point of view.
But if I can just jump in, why wouldn't it hurt to have dropped earlier in the day? It's just there a few hours earlier.
Look, I suspect that that's because that's just when Disney Plus drops its stuff. And that's definitely what is dictating all of this. I'm quite relaxed about it. I think that this is, I was about to say this is the price you pay for being a global TV show, but I don't think it's even a price. It's just a matter-of-fact thing that if you're a global show, and everybody wants Doctor Who to be a global show, they want the money that comes with Doctor Who being a global show, certainly. If you're going to be a global show, then you're going to have a global drop time. And I think they've done this in a fairly sensible sort of way. I've seen two big complaints about this, one of which I get and one I don't. The first complaint is that there are people in the UK who like the fact that Doctor Who has always gone out terrestrially on free-to-air on a Saturday evening. Everybody can watch it at the same time, and then you can have that fan collective community experience of all talking about the episode straight after on the Saturday night. And they're going to be disappointed that that isn't going to exist, because some people will watch it at midnight, some people will watch it when they get up on Saturday morning, some people will wait for the broadcast, and that's going to be slightly different. And I appreciate that that fan community thing is not going to be the same for the UK, although, as I said in one of my tweets, I got a lot of likes from the Antipodeans. Welcome to Australia's experience of the last 20 years. The one that I don't have a lot of sympathy for, but I saw a lot of on Twitter particularly, was the very proprietal British attitude of, this is our show, you don't get to see this before we do. And I've had some quite rude replies, you know, on Twitter, like, well, you don't pay the BBC license fee, so you should get staffed. It's like, well, no, but I do pay my Disney Plus annual subscription, and I do buy the DVDs and the Blu-rays, and have probably via licensing given a lot of money to the BBC over a long time, and now I give money to Disney Plus, so I actually have an equal investment in this. I don't pay your hypothecated TV tax, but I do pay my streaming fee. So, you know, deal with it. Look, it is what it is. It'll be interesting to see how it affects the UK. I know that I wouldn't stay up to watch something at midnight. I'm usually pretty good at midnight, but by the time 1 a.m. comes around, I'm not. And I'm not sure that sort of, you know, struggling to stay awake whilst watching Doctor Who is the best way to watch it. I look forward to seeing it on a Saturday morning. It's great for us, Rob.
Yeah, look, it is, but I think it always would have played out that way anyway. Again, I just come back to how the 60th did it. I think that was fine and it worked for everyone. Why change it? And one thing I'll add, Dave, everything on streaming starts at a weird time for some countries somewhere. And as a little test, I went and looked when The Mandalorian Season 3 was dropping. Disney was dropping that at 3 a.m. East Coast and 12 a.m. West Coast when those episodes were going out. And this is in the home market in the US. So Disney had no problem dropping it at a really bizarre time for the US market, which made it, I think, 8 a.m. in the UK, 7 p.m. on the East Coast here in Australia. We got a really good deal out of that. So it seems there's no rhyme or reason to when Disney drops things. Again, The Mandalorian dropped at a bizarre time for the US. So I just think the simplest way was just to do it like at the 60th. And I don't know why that changed. I'd love to know why it changed, actually.
Yeah, Netflix, I think, generally drops midnight New York time, I think.
Right.
Which works out quite well for us because it's always about 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, depending on daylight saving here. So we always get Netflix shows at a pretty decent hour. You know, usually you come home from work and the show's just dropped. So look, it's interesting. Again, from Australia's point of view, it's kind of like, well, you know, it's just a same stuff, different, very, you know, different theme. I get that the UK is probably the one that's locked out of that, and there's been different reactions to that. But you know, as I say, this is just part of being a global show now, and somebody was going to be put out, and I think we're now seeing a case of perhaps trying to balance the UK and America in a way they hadn't before, and not quite satisfying either. We'll see how it works. But what was particularly interesting was the way that this was dropped, and this caused a couple of hours of confusion for some, angst for others, where they just said, Doctor Who announcement, worldwide dropping time, 11th of May. And everyone's gone, huh? So first of all, there was this sort of shock that, okay, it was going to be a global drop time. And then people were sort of starting to do the maths and go, well, hang on, if it's dropping on the 11th of May, then there's a certain... It said the 11th of May in some countries and 10th of May in others. And people are going, oh, hang on, well, if it's the 10th of May in America and the 11th of May in the UK, then the window in which it can be dropped is actually pretty small. We were all sort of trying to do that maths and work out what it meant for Australia. And then it's like, oh, hang on, you can't just do what it is now, because we have to subtract our daylight saving and add the UK's daylight saving by May. And it was all sort of a bit weird. And people were like, well, what does this mean? What's happening? And it was about 2 hours later that there was a proper detailed tweet that said, midnight UK, 7 o'clock New York, etc.
Yeah.
If you're going to change the lives of UK fans, at least give them the full story when you do it.
Oh, yeah, with just the raw dates, there were fans in the UK tweeting, America's getting it the day before us. You know, what's going on? You know, it's the Five Doctors all over again. and it's like, no, it's actually going out at the same time. It's just a time zone thing, yeah.
Yeah, it was all a little bit clumsy, and it did seem to come out of nowhere. There'd been lots of speculation about, well, how does it work? You know, is it going to be like the specials, as you say, Rob, where it will broadcast on the UK and at the same time drop on Disney? Is there going to be some disparity? We now know that there will be no disparity, but it will not be based on the UK time.
Yeah, that's it.
But we're only a couple of months, less than a couple of months, about 6 weeks away from new Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting stuff. And I guess tying into that, Dave, is we've had a new trailer. Now, I say a new trailer because I believe tomorrow, the day after we're recording this, there will be another new trailer, which will have all the episode names in it. But this is the first of the new trailers we're going to discuss here. And what an interesting trailer drop it was, Dave. I mean, we've got David Bowie's changes blasting away and a lot of goofy stuff happening, like Ruby being scared she'll step on a butterfly and change time. And she does step on one and she becomes this weird alien-like creature. And I thought, ooh, perhaps that's a moment where the Doctor's just going to blink and she's back to normal. You know, she never actually changed. I don't know how that fits into the episode, or is it something that's not even in the episode? It's just a funny thing for the trailer. I don't know. But as the trailer goes on, there's a lot of really traumatic stuff too. We see Shooty at the doors of the TARDIS letting out this real sort of primal scream, like something very, very, very bad has just happened. We see a TARDIS parked on a hillside and there's moss and plant life growing up around it like it's been there for a long time. Why? You know, we see a totally destroyed London in what seems to be the 1960s Beatles episode. Although later we do see everyone dancing around in the Abbey Road studio singing. And suddenly I thought, oh no, don't let that episode have a cool moment like, you know, London's been destroyed. Then they go back in time and have a jolly song and dance and that saves the world, you know, with the Beatles. Oh my God, no. Because writ large in the trailer is literally some wording about being able to change time. And I thought, oh, how's that going to work? Is the Doctor now going against the whole key concept of the show? Is this all about changing time this season? Some interesting times ahead, I think, Dave.
Yeah, look, Rob, you know my view on trailers. I watch them, they happen, and then I move on. My takeaway from this trailer for the most part was, oh, there's a new series coming and stuff will happen in it. Cool. And I'm not one of those people that sort of goes back and watches it again and again and goes, what could this one be about? Because usually all that speculation is completely wrong and a complete waste of time. And I just don't have time in my life to do that sort of thing. Look, I think there's going to be a lot of cool things in this series. You know, the trailer did what it needed to do. It said to me, you know, we're going to go to the 60s and there'll be Beatles. Yay. We're going to have dinosaurs. We're going to have space. Like, great. They're ticking the boxes I want it to tick. That's really good. You can't really take much away from this. I did watch it, though, and there's a part of me that was a little bit, not concerned, that's too strong a word, but I did look at some of the Shooty clips and just it just reinforced this little part of my brain that's going, I'm not quite sold on the new Doctor quite yet. I'm not unsold on him. I don't think he's terrible. I think there's a lot of good about him. I like Shudigatwa. But I'm not yet sold on, like, he is my Doctor and he's great and I love him. And, you know, I don't think that's unreasonable because we've had 10 minutes of him in the giggle when he was playing second fiddle to Tennant. We then had the Church on Ruby Road. Yeah, we had that, and I've got to admit, the further I get away from that, the more I dislike that episode. It just doesn't sit in my memory particularly well, and look, I'm not a fan of Christmas episodes. I don't think that they allow us really to see the Doctor's personality all that well. So look, I'm really waiting to see what the Doctor's like come the series proper. There is a little bit in this trailer that just makes me a little bit nervous. As a couple of our friends out on Twitter put it when I sort of put this thought out there, somebody said, is there a danger he's going to be too cool for school? And the Doctor shouldn't be cool. He shouldn't be hip. He should be the Doctor. And you know, another said, look, this is going to be a very modern take on the Doctor. And that's right. And that's completely appropriate.
Well, I jumped in there on Twitter as well, Dave, and did the screen grab of him saying, you know, give me the lovin' as he comes out of the TARDIS. And I said, are you trying to reconcile this versus Bill or the Pert? And it's like, oh, I can't see my Doctor doing that.
Yeah, look, there is a little bit of that. Absolutely. Now, I'm the first to go, we don't have a context for this, we don't have anything to see, so, you know, let's not get too down on it. I mean, I'm flashing back now to when that leak of Matt Smith, before he'd been on the television doing that, you are the Daleks, and I am the Doctor! And everyone just go, well, this sounds terrible. And then you see it in context, and you sort of get what it's about, and it's actually not too bad. And I suspect they probably used a different take as well. So I'm not judging him from one line, nothing like that. But there's a lot of positivity out of the trailer. There's a lot I like about Shudi, but I'm not quite sold yet, and there is that sort of nagging, is he going to just be too cool to be the Doctor? I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch, and I'm looking forward to watching it. I'm not knocking him. I'm not decided. I'm waiting to see more of this new Doctor.
Yeah, well, I think he's highly charismatic. I think he showed moments of darkness in the Church on Ruby Road, which could be, you know, delved into. And I am excited about the possibility, I think. So maybe like you, I'm not buying into him completely yet because I need to see what he does. But I'm excited about the possibilities if they happen.
No, that's a very good way of putting it. I am definitely excited because if they give us the best of what Shudigatwa has to offer, I think that could be absolutely amazing. If they go down a path where they almost put aside a large amount of what we know as the Doctor just to sort of appeal again to that Saturday tea time audience, maybe that would concern me, but maybe I'm even overthinking this too much and I just need to shut up, put it in the back of my mind, just, you know, not judge anything based on the road on Ruby Church, whatever it was, and just wait for May and enjoy it.
Does it turn into series one again for you, Dave, with Eccleston, and a few stories in, you're saying, yeah, this isn't for me, and then by about the fourth or fifth episode, you go, oh my God, I love this.
Look, absolutely, that's possible. And that's certainly Russell T. Davies' modus operandi. He always does those slightly silly, slightly light, goofy stories to start to get all the mass audience in. And then once they're hooked, he then sort of turns up the Doctor Who-ishness a bit more for the fans. So, yeah, look, I'm very, very open to that. And I mean, I'm not judging the show based on the Christmas episode, because Christmas episodes are their own thing, particularly under Russell T. Davies. So as much as I didn't like the Ruby on Church Road, I'm just, you know, look, I'm going in circles now. Let's keep going.
Yeah, there's only so many variations of that title we can do.
That's true as well. Look, something we do know is coming at some point in the new series is an episode written by a little-known writer by the name of Stephen Moffat. Now, I know Stephen Moffat because he wrote Press Gang.
Yes.
I tease, of course. Former showrunner Stephen Moffat, to read a paragraph from the BBC's official announcement. Former showrunner Stephen Moffat makes an explosive return to the new series of Doctor Who as he writes an episode due to air in Shudigatwa's first season as the 15th Doctor, which will simultaneously premiere across BBC iPlayer in the UK and Disney Plus where available. So Moffat is back.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all we actually know.
Yeah, and look, one thing I did when this came out is I jumped back to a video I made a year ago saying Moffat is back on our YouTube channel, and that was based off a Daily Mirror report which came out, and I remember vividly at the time it came out, said Moffat will be back, and fans, a certain kind of fan, would say, no, that's not true. The Mirror always gets it wrong. No, it just won't happen. And I can remember arguments at the time a year ago with me saying, well, no, they got it right about this and that and this other thing and this and this.
The Mirror's done pretty well over the time.
Since about 2016, the Mirror's hit rate is more hit than miss. It's probably up there around 90%.
Yeah.
So I actually went back and found the Mirror article and blasted it out. They said, look, this is what the Mirror said a year ago, guys. Some of you were denying it. Just take note next time they do get these things right.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm excited. I think that I once made a list of sort of, you know, my top dozen or so episodes of New Who and my bottom dozen or so episodes of New Who, and half of both lists were written by Stephen Moffat, and I hope that this will be one of those top ones.
But vitally, where he's at the top is that Moffat writing under RTD.
I actually give him a 50% hit rate under RTD. I know a lot of people love all of his episodes. I absolutely love Blink and the Empty Child Doctor Dances. I don't like Silence in the Library at all, and I'm pretty ambiguous on the horse French one, the name of which escapes me.
Yes, so with Madame de Pompadour.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of that one, and I can't stand Silence in the Library, but I love Blink and I absolutely love The Empty Child, so hopefully it'll be more like those ones. But hey, look, Moffat's a great writer, and it's going to be good to see him back. And it's good to have somebody from the past back. I think that RTD does need to go back and say to good writers from his era and from Moffat's era and from the Chibnall era and get these people back over the next couple of years. I would love to see Vinay Patel back. I don't want him to just be a Chibnall era writer. Is Gaddis going to be back? I wouldn't be shocked.
Well, there's less slots to play with these days, but yes, I would love to see that too.
Absolutely. And look, by the time this goes out, it's very possible that everybody will know that because that trailer will have dropped. So on Sunday, our listeners have a choice. You can listen to the Doctor Who show and then watch the trailer, or vice versa. I wonder which one they'll choose.
Very good.
One more news story from you, Robin. It's more of a watching brief than a story.
Yeah, I've been keeping my eye out, Dave, for the BBC to finally have some sort of stage-managed rumours of Millie's demise. And we're talking about Millie Gibson here, of course. Rumours of Millie's demise are greatly exaggerated. You know, we're delighted to say she's sticking around for season two. That sort of messaging. But wow, the BBC is really playing its cards close to its chest. It's just let this story that Millie's been punted run and run and run, hoping people forget it's a thing, maybe? I don't know. It's so strange. Even its propaganda arm in Doctor Who magazine has a Millie interview this month, and I've read it, and it's very vague as to when the interview was actually done. It feels like it was done during the filming of the first series, although it does throw in some comments about her overseas holiday between Series 1 and Series 2, which was referenced in some of the reports saying she'd been punted. They were saying Doctor Who's back filming and she's still on holidays, all that sort of thing. And the article also mentioned she's back in Series 2. But vitally, so did the reports of her being punted. They all said, well, she'll be back for a few episodes in Series 2. The Dwim article doesn't give us anything concrete. It's all Millie's back in Series 2, full stop. Giving the more casual fans, I think, a sense that she's in all of it, but not saying otherwise. So it seems the official word from the BBC and Bad Wolf is a very royal family-esque never complain, never explain. Just keep pushing the line that she's in Series 2, she's in Series 2, she's in Series 2. Surely the new companion has to be mentioned sometime though, Dave. Surely she has to get a Dwim cover at some stage, you know?
I think once they decided that they weren't going to get ahead of the leaked location filming of the new companion, I think that really said to me that they weren't going to make an announcement until they wanted to. And I suspect they won't make an announcement until we are well underway in Series 1 of Shooty, if not completed Series 1 of Shooty. I think that they have decided that only sort of people who are online and active fans are really worrying about this speculation and reading these articles. The general public probably isn't. And therefore, let's not rock the boat before the season even opens. Let's not say to them one of our stars has walked or been pushed or whatever before the first season even airs. Let's have it air, and then we will do something ahead of series two. Now, whether that's halfway through the next series, whether that's at the end of the next series, whether it's a bit after, I don't know. But I think they are trying to preserve the ratings or the enthusiasm for this coming set of episodes. And if that means that a few people online and a few people on podcasts are taking pot shots, they're willing to cop that.
Yeah, very well said.
Well, that's the news. No doubt there'll be even more breaking in the next couple of days, because that's always what happens here at the Doctor Who Show. Even when we're recording 24 hours before, we know that we're going to get episode titles in 24 hours. So that's just our curse, and we have a cross to bear at this Easter, as many others do.
Yes.
Short topics. One from me, Rob. I went back and watched The Brain of Morbius last week. I was inspired to do this by our friends over at Pull to Open, who did a episode on The Brain of Morbius. The randomizer took them to the Hinchcliffe era for that one. And I just thought, I haven't watched this show for a very, very long time. It's one of those stories that you go, I know it's good. I enjoy watching it. I don't need to watch it again. Let's watch something else. And I think, no. Let's go back and watch it. And my goodness, is that a great story of Doctor Who. Yeah. It's so well written. I think you can see some of the Terence Dicks ideas and some of the Terence Dicks lines are in there, but over the top of that, you've got the Robert Holmes rewrite that works really, really well. You have, of course, got Philip Madoc in probably his best role in Doctor Who, just absolutely loving it. It looks good. The music's very good. I think Dudley Simpson has perhaps listened to Jeffrey Bergen's score for The Terror of the Zygons and go, oh, I like that. I could do a bit of that. And you do hear a few more strings in the like than Dudley would normally use. Kondo's death is perhaps the most violent moment in all of Doctor Who, where his guts are literally blown out. That is quite extraordinary. But
yeah,
the big thing that was really interesting to me was I was watching the scene where Morbius's brain falls on the floor and Philip Madoc, as Solon, picks it up and he's having this big monologue about the greatest intellect in the universe killed, etc. and all the rest of it. And I thought, my initial reaction was, this is amazing. This is where an actor taking the part utterly seriously with good dialogue can make holding a dumb rubber brain look really effective and just really sell that moment. And then I had a moment of thought, but if you're not that type of viewer and if you're not that type of fan, this is just an actor very earnestly trying to make us pretend that a very dodgy looking rubber brain that just dropped on the floor is for real. And I can kind of see how maybe a lot of the general public would look at that and go, this is just terrible. This is just embarrassing. This is just cringe. And maybe that's a good insight into sort of the different way that fans of classic Doctor Who view the show compared to perhaps others who look back at old TV and just go, this is terrible.
Yeah. I love that story. I did probably overdo it watching the BBC video of it in the 80s. Was it the 80s? Maybe it was the early 90s.
No, I think it was the 80s, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen it so many times that I haven't seen it for a long, long time, Dave, because it would be just a story I see on the shelf and think, yeah, classic, don't need to watch it though. But you're sort of tempting me to go watch it now.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to remember that, you know, our favourite stories are our favourite stories for reasons, and go back and just enjoy them. Yeah. It's very tempting to go, oh, I'll watch this story I don't remember that well, or I'll watch this story I don't like and see if I can find something to like about it. And sometimes you just have to go and watch a classic.
Exactly.
You've been watching some classic Who as well, Rob?
My season 15 box set came this past week, and the first thing I went to was the final disc in the set that has all the special features that don't really relate to any given story. I mean, there's even clips from the 50th anniversary in London, like Louise Jamison interviews and things like this, wonderful stuff on there. But specifically, I went to the Graham Williams documentary because I'd been hearing about this one for some time. Largely tweets from Chris Chapman, who made the thing. He's a documentary maker. He's been talking it up for a long time. But also, some people saw it at a screening. I presume it was probably the BFI or something like that. And my eye had been caught by Chapman and others warning people, and I say warning in quotation marks, after the screening, with how they spoke about the piece after seeing it. And having seen it now, I presume they mean the way people talk about William's passing, which was obviously quite traumatic. I don't think it's ever been a secret, but I suppose it's the kind of thing that'd be considered triggering for people. And in light of that, I want to mention how delicately and nicely it's all handled. And I hate the word nice, but it does apply here. I mean, you've got Graham's wife and three children, a bunch of Doctor Who alum and friends of Graham who were there all through his life and then his death. Talking in such a way, it's just really well handled. I mean, some of Tom Baker's reactions are extraordinary. There's one where he literally apologizes for the way he treated Graham when he was the doctor. And there's another where he realizes Williams was 45 when he died. And he breaks down. It's not something you see too often with Tom, the whole facade slipping and the real person underneath sort of coming through a bit more.
Mm.
I mean, even earlier in the doco, he's being a bit silly about not liking Graham's shiny shoes. Sounds like a goodies thing, doesn't it? Shiny shoes, you know. And Tom's being Tom. Oh, yeah, it's shiny shoes. I don't trust people with shiny shoes or something, you know. But at the end, Tom is just bereft. He's just pondering it all, like, you know, you say he was 45 when he died, you know, and he's just like, he's blown away. So for people who get the set and just stick on the first disc and start from there, truly do yourself a favor, take that first disc out, put on the final disc, watch the Williams doco first, or at least watch it sooner rather than later. It's a really interesting and lovely piece of film. I hope it's not hidden away on that final disc for people not to find.
That's a really good tip, Rob, and I'll definitely go out and watch it. Unfortunately, my box set has arrived in Australia, but I always get mail sent to the office rather than home because I'm not home in the day and I don't want stuff being diverted to the post office and everything. So I always get it sent to the office. And so it is sitting on my desk in the Melbourne office, and I've spent the last week in the Canberra office, and we're now on the Easter long weekend. So it's going to be well over a week before I'm united with my Blu-ray set, which is sitting on my desk in Melbourne, which is very
torture.
Sad.
Yes, torture day.
Very, very frustrating. I could have spent the whole Easter long weekend watching Doctor Who and all these docos, but I can't.
Instead, you're stuck with me.
I'm stuck with you telling me how awesome the stuff I can't watch is. So, thank you for that, Rob. And I look forward to seeing it.
Mm.
On to our main topic.
Yes, here we go.
Time to put on our monk's habits, get out our TARDISes and our lists. And look, this is a segment all about just looking at alternate histories of Doctor Who. I think that it's not been unusual for people like us and others to do lists of important moments that could have been different or what might have changed it. But we want to go a little bit further into this. We've got 11 moments and we're going to change something and just see how that would have played out. And I think, Rob, you and I both found as we did this that it was that how would this change actually play out over time that was more interesting than the change itself. I know that the ones I've picked are all things that I think are realistic, that could have happened or potentially were even mooted. And and so I don't think we're doing anything extraordinary, but it is. It's just about what's the moment we're changing and then what happens from there. It's the what if the Nazis won the war of Doctor Who.
Yeah, absolutely. I had so much fun with this, just thinking of the moments that could be changed that were semi-real. I mean, a couple of mine maybe are a bit, you know, fantastical, but they could have happened. And if they did happen, what would happen? Yeah, and it's what would happen that is interesting.
Yeah, I think all of mine were mooted as possible.
Okay.
So they are paths that we could have gone down. So without any further ado, Rob, I'm going to step off the path, tread on a butterfly, and watch the repercussions from there. And
oh, you're an alien, Dave.
Yeah. I wonder what that is about. That's going to be curious.
Yeah.
We'll get there. So, look, I've got the first one, which is what if Terry Nation had got his standalone Dalek show up, and as a result, Doctor Who lost the Daleks forever after season 4?
Wow.
Now, we know that this was possible because the production team actually planned for it, and that's the reason why Evil of the Daleks was done as the final end to the Daleks, and then we don't see them for a couple of years because Nation had said, you can't use them anymore, I'm shopping them around, I'm trying to get a shop in the UK and then a shop in the US. So, if Nation had got this Dalek standalone show up, I think a few things would be very different now. potentially now, Evil of the Daleks isn't just seen as this lost classic, but would be seen as the actual legendary grand finale of the Daleks forever. And the Daleks would just be this thing that happened in the 1960s. We only have three of their stories actually available to watch, so 40% of the Daleks wouldn't even exist. And I think that the way we talk about them would absolutely change. They would be seen as just this 1960s sort of, maybe even a little bit bizarre or odd thing that maybe would say, oh, that could only have happened in the 60s, it would never have worked anywhere else. And they would be looked on very differently. Now, what does the production team do from then? Well, I'm going to speculate that the Cybermen would come back in the Pertwee era. Because Barry Letts would be looking around, and where he said, I need a big launch to my season, I need some big linchpins to my season, I'll get the Daleks back, that always gets us publicity, he'd go, well, it's a shame I can't have the Daleks, but, well, the Cybermen are the next best thing. Let's commission some Cybermen stories. Sorry, Terrence, I know you hate the Cybermen, but go make it work. And maybe Terrence Dix would have a very different spin on the Cybermen, given he did notoriously not like them, but maybe the Pertwee era is known as the continuation of the Cybermen era. Are the Cybermen now seen as the villain of Doctor Who, and the Daleks are a bit of a sort of a secondary monster, maybe a bit like the Ice Warriors, perhaps? They're just this thing that was in a couple of eras and a couple of stories. The Cybermen probably get a bit of a redesign for the Pertwee years. They probably get another story in the Tom Baker years. What happens with Earthshock? I think Earthshock would probably still do a big redesign, but it wouldn't be the big, it's the first time you've seen the Cybermen in 10 years. It would just be another thing. So Earthshock's now a very different story as well. Going on from that, do the Daleks come back in New Who? I think maybe, but probably in something like Series 4. They wouldn't be the big, we've got to bring the Daleks back. That's the first thing we'd bring back. It would have been, no, we're bringing the Cybermen back in Series 1, and we're going to bring the Sontarans back in Season 2, and the Ice Warriors, and, oh, what else are we going to bring back? Oh, you don't remember the Daleks? They had a couple of cool stories in the Hartnell era. Let's bring those back. But the final thing is, it would have changed the entire British consciousness of Doctor Who, because Doctor Who, I think, in the British general public's mind, is inextricably linked with the Daleks. It's Doctor Who and the Daleks. And indeed, when they've done stuff like the big anniversary stamp, it wasn't the Doctor, it wasn't the TARDIS, it was a Dalek on the stamp. And that whole link would be different, particularly as there would still have been the Cushing movies. So it would have just been even more this kitsch 60s thing. And Nations TV series, maybe a bit of a sort of a weird oddity, particularly if it was done in America. It would have been this sort of very Americanized, almost probably Star Trek meets the Daleks type thing. And probably there'd be a lot of Doctor Who fans that go, well, that was sort of, you know, that was the final nail in the coffin for the Daleks. They didn't know what to do with them and they just made them generic monsters, yada, yada, yada. Life could be very different if the Daleks didn't come back after Evil, as was very, very possible.
My take is they would have come back in the classic era. I think Nation's show wouldn't have lasted long. It would have been weird. I don't think it's a great concept for a show. Obviously, that's why it didn't get picked up, right? But I think Nation loved making money. And I think by the time of, say, the 20th anniversary, you know, the Five Doctors might have been the Five Doctors fighting the Daleks who finally return. I don't think they would have waited for New Who, Dave. I think they would have come back by 83.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. And look, I get that, you know, the main timeline went in a particular course because it was the more obvious thing to do. That is certainly possible. I think that potentially Terry Nation maybe wasn't quite the name he was without the Daleks carrying him on in that sense. And maybe if it had flopped, that show may have hurt his reputation. Maybe he doesn't get Survivors up. Maybe Blake 7 doesn't happen if Terry Nation isn't Terry Nation and the Daleks. It's very weird when you start stepping on butterflies. But look, you're absolutely right. And the main timeline, I think, is the main timeline for a reason in this case. But it just was a nice little bit of 60 speculation for me.
Yeah. And look, even if they did come back in 83 for the 20th, you still lose a decade of Pertwee versus the Daleks and Baker versus the Daleks and arguably the greatest or one of the greatest Dalek stories ever in Genesis. You lose all of that. So the Daleks would still lose something, you know, in the public consciousness, easily.
Yeah, and if JNT was bringing the Daleks back for the first time since Season 4, would he have gone the full Earthshock and redesigned them?
That's scary.
Because you could see him doing that.
Yeah, well, Nation would have to agree, though, surely.
Ooh, now we're getting into very, very interesting territory. But, of course, Davros wouldn't have been created.
No.
So Davros has gone from the timeline either way.
Exactly right, yep.
Well, there you go. Rob, you're continuing in the late 60s, I have, according to our list.
Yes, Dave. I'm going to start here with something a bit... I don't think it's strange, but I'm going to start with the BBC's decision to junk or record over many of the First and Second Doctor episodes rather than archive them.
Ooh.
It might seem an odd one to start with, but I think the concept of missing episodes has loomed behind the fandom of basically anyone who gets into the classic stuff beyond being a casual sort of fan. I remember it firsthand in the 80s as I got deeper into Doctor Who. You learn pretty quickly the series is incomplete. And you almost go through the stages of grief, you know, denial that such a thing is possible, anger at the way the shows were treated, then bargaining, which I guess for this is asking what-if questions. What if copies still exist in the desert somewhere, you know, in a desert outpost? What if they're behind a filing cabinet and someone's just forgotten them? Then, of course, depression that this is a thing and you'll likely never see all of the shows. And then finally, acceptance that if a new episode or story is found, great, but don't count on it. And the sliding door moment here, Dave, you know, the butterfly effect moment, is that instantly this feeling of loss, these stages of grief would never have existed for any of us. We would have a show like so many 60s shows that are complete. You can watch the original Star Trek, it exists. You can watch The Prisoner, it exists. You know, Doctor Who could be like that, but it isn't. And I wonder what a different experience that would be for people not listening to copies of the audios, as they were the only way to experience these things for decades, outside of the Target novels, I guess. The animations aren't a thing because they don't need to animate anything. It's a whole different ballgame on some levels, and it could have happened if the BBC had just had more care and a more of an archival mindset with this stuff. So I wanted to start with that one.
That's absolutely fascinating. It would have changed a lot of our fan experiences in yes, a really big way. I think that had the episodes existed, we absolutely would have got repeats here in Australia of the Hartnell and the Troughton era, because mm-hmm. they certainly repeated a couple of Troughton stories in the 80s, and then in the 90s they did some repeats, and in the 2000s they repeated all the complete 60s story. So the ABC had no problem repeating black and white Doctor Who if they had it. So,
and UK TV on Foxtel were showing black and white Doctor Who. They would have shown them all.
They would have shown them all. So these things would have existed. I think the biggest thing that would have changed is the perception of the First Doctor. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many people who've written and spoken on podcasts. The guys over at Flight Through Entirety did this in at length when they watched the Hartnell era. Of people watching the Hartnell era and realizing that the First Doctor isn't who they thought he was. That they always thought he was this grumpy, curmudgeonly bloke because they've only really seen An Unearthly Child and the Daleks, because that's the way that he was written about for 20 years before anyone had seen the episodes. And they've missed that warmth to him, that cheekiness to him. As you put it, Rob, that Yoda type attitude that the First Doctor has. And I think that would have been very, very different. We would have talked about the Troughton era very differently. There wouldn't have been this eulogising, mythologising of the season 5 monster season that has slowly been rediscovered. We would have just been watching that, and it wouldn't have been a myth. It just would have been what it was.
Well, there was a time where, you might know this stat, Dave, season 5, how much of it existed? Like only a few episodes. There wasn't much before they started finding stories.
Yeah, there were no complete stories in season 5 before Tomb was found.
Yeah.
And now there's nearly 3.
Yeah, that's it.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, how many lives have been dedicated to finding missing episodes?
Yeah, none of that would have... I mean, those people might have gone looking for other shows that were missing, perhaps, but... You know, in terms of Doctor Who, it just would have been a whole new experience. We would have seen the whole... We would have had that 30,000-foot view from the start of everything. Yeah, what a shame.
What a shame. Wow, okay. I've got the next one, Rob. I'm jumping forward to season 15. And this dovetails in well with what you were talking about with the Graham Williams era. My season 15 what if is, what if The Invasion of Time hadn't been made? What if Graham Williams had just looked at the budget, looked at the production problems that they were having and just gone, I can't make this last story. I'm just dropping this story. It's just not happening. That I think, would have had a number of repercussions. First of all, the invasion of time would now be this legendary lost story that people always talked about. Oh, they were going to have this story where some Tyrans invaded Gallifrey and, oh, it was going to be this big end-of-season epic. By now, there would absolutely be a Big Finish adaption of it.
Yes.
And that would be very, very interesting. But I think you then look at the ramifications of that. And what Williams would have done, he said, right, I'm now just dropping a story from the season's run. And therefore, I'm putting a bit of that money back into some other stories. So suddenly, some of these stories like Underworld and The Invisible Enemy would have had a little bit more money and a little bit more time. And maybe that improves them. Maybe it rises season 15 a little bit. Not that I don't like The Invasion of Time. I think it's a good story. But that season is very clearly the money is running out right across it. And maybe this would change that perception. Does Williams then go to the BBC or does the BBC go to Williams and say, well, clearly you can't make this many stories a season, so from now on we're just going to do one story less. The Key to Time doesn't have the Armageddon factor.
Ooh.
Sharda is never even commissioned. And so the Horns of Nymon is not only the actual final story, but it probably has all the money that was saved from Sharda. And maybe that's looked at now as a very well-made, well-budgeted little epic mini-classic. That could have changed a whole bunch of things. But what it does also mean is that it starts even sooner this slide in Doctor Who, where Doctor Who goes from being on more often during the year than it's not, and with just the drop of a story, it goes from being on half the year to less than half the year, and suddenly Doctor Who becomes a little bit less a part of the British consciousness. And another little thing that I did think of is, if you don't bring the Suntarans back for season 15... Robert Holmes probably doesn't get upset by their depiction and doesn't feel the need to bring them back for season 22. And so suddenly the Suntarans going from being this four-story monster across a number of eras to, hey, though that thing they did for, you know, 1 year, they had two stories, both played by Kevin Lindsay, really cool, and that's the Suntarans done.
Interesting. You know, there's one element you haven't covered though, Dave.
Yeah?
How do we get rid of Leela? Where does she go?
Well, I think she probably would have married someone in Underworld and gone off to repopulate the minions or something. Yeah.
Yeah, wow, what a thought.
Or does her contract mean that she has to be carried over and is written out in the Rybos operation?
Oh, that could be interesting.
In which case Mary Tam's only in four stories now.
Oh, that's terrible. She's so good.
You see, all these little things that just disappear.
Yeah. I like that one. I do.
Rob, you've got the next one, and you told us on the running notes it is prior to season 21.
Yes, Dave, because for this one, I'm going to get inside JNT's head at the precise moment he has the light bulb moment to make Colin Baker's costume truly tasteless. And I'm going to twist a synapse or block a neuron or whatever it takes for that idea to come and to go. Now, I'm not going to design an alternate costume in this commentary. I think there's 1,000 ways you could dress the Sixth Doctor, and many of them would look smashing. And I know Colin Baker is fond of saying contemporarily, oh, I would have worn all black, or oh, I would have worn what Eccleston wore. But I think these are very much in hindsight type comments. I certainly don't recall him saying anything remotely like that back in the day. I mean, a doctor dressing like Eccleston in the 80s is an absolute fantasy. It would never have been considered, let alone acted on.
Yes.
And the sliding door moment here for me is that while some decisions with the Doctor were shocking, like having him toss Perry around like a rag doll and assault her, or having an attitude that was unlikable, even throwing in the I'm the Doctor, whether you like it or not, lying, because they were very conscious they were doing this, all of those things changed over time. By Vervoids, Colin is absolutely charming and fun. But when you have the costume, and it's one of these 80s uniform costumes, it's just always there. It's clownish and the audience can't see past it. I feel sorry for him being lumbered with it, and it's interesting to think how a more conservatively dressed Doctor would have been taken. Would the Twin Dilemma have been 50% better, 25% better, at least 10% better if the Doctor was doing all the same stuff, embroiled in the same storyline, but he looked more normal? Would it be one less thing to worry about and notice and complain about with the audience and have given him a better start?
That's such a small thing that could have had such massive implications.
Yeah, because it knocks on across his whole era. I mean, the only thing that changes really is his waistcoat.
Yeah, and it changes the way they do set designs and the way they do production and all sorts of things. That could have had quite a significant flow on across his era.
Yeah, and there is that moment in The Twin Dilemma where he does put on Pertwee's velvet jacket for a moment, and he looks fantastic in it. So Colin could have looked very doctorish, very wonderful in all manner of clothes, and to have just gone with that outfit because it stands out, the problem is that's what everyone sees and says, ugh, that stands out. So it does what it says on the packet. It does its job. I get that. But I just think of how disruptive it is. And even now when new fans come to Classic Who and see that, you know, some of them are just like, what the hell is this? You know?
Yeah.
Some of them go with it. Some of them think, oh, that's pretty cool. But, yeah.
Well, I've got one from pretty much the same point in the show's history. And this is perhaps one of the most famous and most talked about what if moments that the Doctor Who fans have. And that is, what if Davo does a fourth season?
Oh, yeah.
Now, we know that Davo was tempted after season 21 to do a fourth season. And I think had he jumped in a little bit sooner and said yes, J&T would have let him. I think J&T asked him, and it's only because he wasn't quite happy with season 20 he said no, and he said, had I had the stories I had in season 21, I would have said yes. So Davo does a fourth season. This changes quite a lot of things. First of all, season 21 plays out differently. I think they probably swap the Twin Dilemma and the Caves of Androzani. So the Twin Dilemma is now done as just a bit of a runaround, a bit of a space opera, a bit of a B-movie sort of type thing. It's got a bit more money because it's not the last one of the season. It doesn't have to have all the regeneration stuff in there. It's just Davo and his new companion fight some giant slugs and some twins. And it's not derided as the worst story ever. It's just, it's not Davo's best, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Caves of Androzani, done, and it's probably not quite the classic we expected because it would have been done on the last story budget, so it would have had a bit less money, and it wouldn't have had all of that build-up to a regeneration. It would just have been, well, the Doctor and Perry drank some bat's milk and everything's okay, we're off on another jolly adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe Caves of Androzani is a big loser from Davo staying on. Season 22 would have been very different. It would have had a very different tone. Probably had some similar stories. They probably still went to Varos. They probably still introduced the Rani, but it's not going to be quite as violent. It's not going to be quite the thing that Colin Baker's Doctor made it. Some fans will like that more. Some fans will dislike that. That's just a thing. But the relationship between Perry and the Doctor, I think, would have been extraordinarily different. I think Perry would have had a much better time on the TARDIS. But the money was still running out. The stories were still losing ratings. And I suspect that the show is still cancelled because Warriors of the Deep still was broadcast and Jonathan Powell, the Michael Grade, would have still watched it and gone, this story's had its time, it's getting one more year and that's it. The problem is that Davo would have been saying, look, 4 years is enough, I'm resigning, I'm going. And the BBC would have said, well, we're cancelling the series, so no regeneration.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that helped save the Doctor Who over the cancellation is that Colin was in harness and they did have a Doctor to bring back. But if the Doctor's resigning, if the Doctor's moving on and you're not doing a regeneration because you're cancelling the show, can the show come back?
Mm.
And I think that if Davo stays for a fourth year, it's just easier for the BBC to cancel it when he goes and it doesn't come back. So we don't get the Colin era. We don't get the McCoy era. We probably don't get the new adventures. Without Colin and McCoy, we certainly don't get Big Finish. And if we don't get those, do we get the revival? It's very, very possible that as much as we go, wouldn't it be awesome if we got Davo for a fourth season? And wouldn't Davo and Perry for a season have been absolutely great? That might just have been a slight rearranging of things that leads to the show being cancelled for good after season 22. And everything we know after that goes as well.
It's interesting. These are all knock-on effects. I thought of one knock back into the future. For Davo to have stayed, it means season 20 would have had to have been really, really good. So so you say all this, Dave, but it means we would have got a really fantastic season 20. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. It's just extraordinary because when you get to that post-season 21 period, the show is always in danger. The show never quite has the certainty going forward. And I think it wouldn't take much of a change for the show to have not come back or suddenly have had less years.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? I don't know whether I would have liked the classic era ending at just five Doctors and then coming back in the future with a sixth Doctor. What would that have felt like? What? Oh, yeah, that's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, and it's very possible that in a lot of fans' minds, the new Sixth Doctor wouldn't have been necessarily valid.
No. No, because no regeneration and so long after the fact, you know, even Sylve came back for the McGann regeneration, you know. Yeah, wow. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've got the next one as well, and I'm jumping forward to 1995, and I'm asking the question, what if Virgin doesn't lose their license?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So this, of course, happened in 1995. There were hints that the show was going to come back in a serious way in 1996. And part of what was happening was all these companies that had Doctor Who licenses to produce merchandise had those licenses called in. They weren't renewed. And the big casualty of that was, of course, the Virgin books, The New Adventures and The Missing Adventures, where they were told, no, 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 we're now taking the show back on and we're going to make the books themselves. Now, I'm not saying that the telemovie doesn't happen. I'm just saying that as part of that process, the BBC doesn't say, well, we're going to make the books themselves. They would have just said, look, we're going to renegotiate for more money, or we want to have a bit more control, but Virgin, you've done well. You can still have those books.
Now, I'll just jump in, Dave, because I know the Virgin books still continued on for a little while, even with Doctor Who stuff. I think The Dying Days comes out in early 97, but it was back here that the pin was being pulled on the license, is it?
That's right. So they were told, you have until the end of this license, and after that, we're not renewing. Right. So they had about 18 months of books to do, which took them up until mid-97. Yep. So this would have continued onwards from there. I'm going to assume that there would still have been a regeneration from McCoy to McGann in the books, just as there was. But rather than it being one book at the end of the run, The Dying Days, it would have been a continuous run of McGann books going on from The Dying Days for many more years to come. And suddenly McGann goes from being a BBC Books doctor, a Big Finish doctor, to being a Virgin New Adventures doctor. And that probably would have been a very different take on the Doctor. The New Adventures had already gone into some quite dark places. They'd gone into a particular sort of adult and grown-up places. And I think they would have continued that with the McGann Doctor rather than the bit of the sort of the friendly reset that the BBC Books do. Now, the BBC Books go on into their own crazy, you know, expanded universe type roles. And a lot of the McGann stuff there is, you know, quite exciting and quite exceptional. But it would have been a very different take on McGann. So his Doctor would have changed quite a bit. The other thing, of course, is that the Benny range doesn't happen, because the only reason that the Benny standalone books happened was because Virgin lost the license to Doctor Who. So they've gone, we'll continue making books in this universe. We just can't use the Doctor. Oh, we'll put Bernie Summerfield in as the main person. Does that mean that Benny doesn't quite become the thing that she is today? They certainly couldn't have done adaptions for Big Finish of those Benny stories, because those Benny stories wouldn't have existed. So does that change a whole lot of the Big Finish range? And what happens to the Virgin books? I suspect that they still peter out over a couple of years, and maybe we got, you know, 2 years of sort of not very popular McGann books, and maybe McGann's not looked on as that great a Doctor. He sort of, well, we had these awesome Sylvester McCoy books with the Times Champion and the Dark Doctor, and then they regenerated him into McGann, and it was all a bit silly and a bit lightweight, and nobody read them, and they stopped buying them, and Doctor Who died. That's very possible, not because McGann wasn't popular, but because the range was already losing readers, because any range like that just loses readers over time, and McGann would have got the fag end of that range, rather than the start of a whole new BBC range. It could have had quite a big effect.
Yeah, that is another really interesting one, Dave. I mean, when you talk about how Virgin would have written The Eighth Doctor, I mean, Kate Orman and John Blum were very instrumental with the BBC range on how he was written, and Kate Orman was certainly there in the Virgin books. So part of me thinks, oh, would they have really done something so radically different to what they did just because they were at the BBC books end of things? I don't know. Or would they have been more influenced by the Virgin writers around them, many of whom didn't cross over?
There would certainly have been some cross-pollination, and I agree, Kate Orman and John Blum absolutely would have done more of that. But I think the directive that the BBC gave them to say, this is a new set of books, put aside all of the established Virgin stuff and start again, wouldn't have been there. And that would have had some subtle changes. And you're right, you're going to get probably a whole bunch of Paul Cornell Eighth Doctor stuff. You got a whole bunch of Mark Gatiss and Gareth Roberts New Adventure Eight McGann Doctors, rather than the writers that came in with the BBC. So would it have been totally different? No, because they would still have been anchored on the telly movie, the portrayal of the Eighth Doctor.
Yeah.
But it certainly would have been different.
Yeah. Gosh, that's fascinating. I love it.
We are continuing on into the 90s. We both have picks from 1996. I don't know if this is going to be a snap, but Robert, what's your 1996 butterfly being tried?
Well, Dave, here I'm infiltrating a Fox Network meeting, and I'm convincing the powers that be to send McGann Doctor Who to series in 1996 for the 1997 TV season.
Snap.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, let's hear yours and then let's hear mine.
Okay. I can already hear people out there saying, oh my God, that awful North American flavor Doctor Who. Are you nuts? But as a fan of sci-fi and fantasy TV made in North America in the 90s, and I dare say you're the same here, Dave, from The X-Files, Star Trek The Next Generation, Buffy, Dark Skies, I know the era could make some good material, and I think the sliding doors moment here for me is even if they made just one series, that's potentially a load of episodes. But what if they made two? What if they made three? And remember, McGann was on a five-year contract if this went to series. What if they made five? Suddenly, McGann goes from being a bloke who's in a TV special to one of the doctors with the most stories full stop. And I guarantee some of them would have been really good because the law of averages says as much. You make a season of 22 episodes and there will be three or four bangers in there, guaranteed. So if greenlighting a McGann series made in North America gave us some bangers and gave us some pretty good stories as well across 22 or 44 or 66 episodes or even more, I mean, can you imagine? And again, that's assuming they went a more Buffy route and did a 22 episode season. I know there was talk of it maybe being six telly movies a year or something like that. But even that's intriguing. Why would you not want that? You know, it does call into question how the series would come back on the BBC one day and be British again and all of that. So maybe it wouldn't have been in 2005. Maybe it wouldn't have been with RTD. That's an interesting thing to ponder too. But for sure, I can't go past making a bunch of McGann TV stories just to see what good stuff fell out of the tree from time to time, because it would have, for sure.
Mine is very similar to yours, Robert, perhaps going in a slightly different direction. Mm. The first thing I've written here on my notes under telemovie goes to series are the words, fans hate it.
Right.
And I think that probably would have been the reaction. I agree with you that we should be looking at the contemporary television of the time coming out of America. Buffy's a part of that, Roswell's a part of that, but they were both fairly minor sort of shows. Babylon 5, all of those were very cult shows on smaller networks that fans found, fans loved, but they were never mainstream hits. The one that was a mainstream hit and was on the same network was The X-Files. And I think this basically just would have been The X-Files, but with the Doctor in it. Mm. I agree it would have been 22 episode series, and that would have been a lot of good content, but I think it would have been very different to what fans know and expect of Doctor Who. It would have been a lot more contemporary set stories. There would have been a lot more walking around in America in the 1990s.
In the dark.
In the dark, absolutely, absolutely. I think that when they've done historicals, it would have been much more American historicals. So you would have seen stuff with cowboys and Indians. You would have seen stuff in the Civil War, that sort of thing. They'd probably go and do lots of episodes about the civil rights movement because that's the sort of stuff that 90s American television was starting to talk about. So it would have felt very American, not just because we would have had an American companion and all of the actors would have been American, and when you go into space, suddenly everybody speaks with an American accent, not a British accent. So it would have felt very, very different just in that practical sense. But the stories they were telling would have been American stories, and where they're doing, you know, allegories of various things, it would have been allegories about McCarthyism, for example, or just stuff that Americans are worried about more than stuff that the British are worried about. So the whole tone would have been very, very different. And I don't think that would have worked well for fans of British Doctor Who. I think we would have seen a lot more romance in that. Potentially, the McGann Doctor has a love interest in every episode. He becomes the Captain Kirk of Doctor Who. You know, every episode he has a beautiful woman hanging off him because that's what happened in the TV movie. Yeah. So, you know, do they go down that path? I think that it probably wouldn't quite have worked. Yes, there would have been some very good episodes, because as you say, Law of Averages says that there would have been, and that they were making a lot of good television back in those days. But trying to make American TV and British TV gel in that manner has almost never worked. you look at any UK TV series that's been adapted over to the US, most of them fail utterly. And the ones that succeed are stuff like The Office or Queer as Folk, where they just go in a completely different direction and don't even pretend to be riffing on the British stuff. The Office riffs on British stuff for about four episodes and then says, this isn't working, we're doing our own thing, and it's nothing like the British series. Queer as Folk doesn't even pretend that they're going to do the same thing as the British. They have about two plot points in the first couple of episodes and then just go, we're now doing our own thing. And I think if you do your own thing, it's not Doctor Who, and no one would have watched it. If you don't do your own thing, it's not going to be a homogenous working sort of thing, and it probably gets cancelled after maybe two seasons. And if Doctor Who has 44 episodes of McGann, yep, McGann's a bigger Doctor, he's a bigger part of it, but he's that American Doctor.
Yeah.
And if Doctor Who has a big revival and then gets cancelled, does it get another go at a revival? Or do people say it's had two iterations now, that's enough?
I think it would get another go because the second iteration was American. And I think the Brits would think, well, we want to have another crack at it.
That's very possible. Certainly, I think that third iteration would have eventually been a reaction to the American one.
Yes.
And that would have been interesting to see as well. So it certainly would have been different to what we got.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rob, you've got the next one. We're now into Modern Who. You've said Series 1.
Yes, Dave, I'm time meddling here. I want to get in RTD's ear around the time of writing Series 1 and swerve him away from what I'm going to call smoochy romance, which admittedly wasn't as much a thing in Series 1, but it did begin there. The Doctor and Rose have a big pash at the end of the series, and then it leads into Tennant and Piper running around like boyfriend and girlfriend in the next series. And suddenly, the show has attracted that kind of fan, and Doctor Who has changed forevermore. And the sliding doors moment is, if we don't go down that path, suddenly we don't have to worry about the next companion, and the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. Because if we're to believe the Doctor is now sexually attracted to late teens, early 20s girls, even though he's over 1,000, which is kind of ick when you think about it, we now have in general this, well, is he going to be into the next companion, you know? And particularly after a regeneration, it's like, well, this is a whole new guy and this is a new companion. Surely we can make it happen again and again and again. And putting aside whether it's the right vibe or not for Doctor Who, and I don't think it is, I think this constant baiting of the audience into whether the Doctor will be in love with or have a relationship with their companions isn't the most interesting thing to be pursuing and writing into scripts. I think if we kept the more traditional asexual Doctor character, we not only go down a route of television that's different to everything else out there, which is interesting in its own right, but we also avoid having to jam it into stories and avoid having to answer the question with every new companion who comes along. I think, yeah, smoochy romance must go, Dave.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think that it has an effect on the general public?
By which you mean non-fans?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
I'll happily admit that. I think that the general public goes, oh, there's a guy and a girl and they're in love. Oh, isn't that fantastic? And they're not thinking he's over 1,000, she's 19, you know, and he did it with the last one and the one before that and the one before that. They're not thinking about that stuff. Of course they're not. But for a fan, yeah, it's weird.
Yes. No, very true. I have a similar but slightly different sliding doors moment here. I'm going back in my time metal TARDIS and I'm having a quiet word to Christopher Eccleston. I'm taking him out for a couple of drinks and saying, mate, it's not that bad. Give it another go.
Yes.
And stick around for at least another year.
Yeah.
I think this would have changed the show in quite an interesting sort of way if Eccleston sticks around. Because like you, I think that we don't quite get the same level of lovey-dovey stuff that they did with Tennant and Rose. There's still something going on there, but I don't think it was ever quite as big a deal with Eccleston and Rose as it was with Tennant and Rose. I also think that Eccleston sticking around, and particularly the sort of conversation he would have had with RTD, who said, look, I'll do you another series, but no more Space Pigs, would have been important. And I think that that would have encouraged RTD to lean into the darker impulses that we know he has in his writing when given the chance. And so we would have had not a completely dark and bleak sort of series. Of course that wouldn't have happened, but there would have been a slightly darker sort of tone and a slightly less light tone, certainly a slightly less smug tone to the next series and potentially the ones after that if Eccleston had continued. I think that if Eccleston stays for 2, 3, maybe 4 years, regenerating the Doctor now becomes a lot harder. It's something that you do quite quickly in the show and people just go, oh, this is a thing that happens. They change the actor every now and then. Now it would have gone, oh, well, the lead actor's gone, so they've had to recast. I'm not sure I like this idea. And it wouldn't have been quite a normal thing for the general audience. I think the show's still quite popular. Does it quite have the boom of the Tennant years? Maybe not. But I still think it's quite popular. I still think it lasts. I still think it gets recommissioned. Moffat still probably takes over. And we sort of go from there. But I think that what we would have got would have been not a very different tone, but a slightly different tone. And Eccleston would certainly not be the new Doctor the BBC tries to quietly forget, because we don't want to talk about him. He would have been the face of New Who.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's one thing, you say you'd go down this darker sort of path. I mean, contemporarily, and this is similar to Colin Baker saying, I would have dressed in black or I would have dressed like Eccleston. Eccleston talks a lot now that he would have liked to have explored his comedy more. But I don't know whether that's a more recent sort of revelation for him. I don't know whether that's something he really would have done at the time, because he was still an actor at the time and, you know, still doing Hollywood films and things like this. So I'm not sure how much that would have come out. But I completely agree that, you know, without Tennant coming in and Doctor Who suddenly skyrocketing, it would have stayed at this other, I don't want to say lower level, but it is a lower level. And it would have been a different thing. Absolutely. Yeah.
It still would have been big. It might not have been quite the phenomenon.
That's it. That's the way to put it.
Yeah, so interesting. Look, I would love to have seen more Eccleston.
Me too.
But it wouldn't have been, you know, you can't just put Eccleston into series two, you know, change the actor and think the scripts don't change. Of course they change. Yeah. And as I say, the demands that Eccleston probably would have made to come back, I think would have shaped series two.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
We have one more, Rob. I said we're going to do 11, but in fact we've done 10 because we had a snap. So our 10th and final one is from Rob. And you've told us it's from 2020.
Yes. To round us out, Dave, I'm getting into Chris Chibnall's ear just as he comes up with the idea of the Timeless Child.
Because okay.
Vitally, Dave, I don't think the idea is all bad. In fact, there's good to it. And to start, I think I'd like to know how it formed in his head. Did it form as the Doctor isn't Gallifreyan and is going to be the focal point of all modern Time Lord society, and he worked back from that thought, in which case I might have a lot of work to do as a time meddler, or did it grow more organically from a thought like, the Time Lords came across this little humanoid alien which could regenerate itself, and they experimented on it quite cruelly until they could do the same. In which case I'd be like, yes, stop now, Chris, stop now, because before you take it any further, before you say, and that little alien was the Doctor, you need to stop. Just stop. You already have the story that at the heart of Time Lord society is a dirty little secret. They did horrible things to an alien, a child, if you like, a female child, if you really like. And for millennia, this hasn't been well known at all. Yes, 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 that's something to work with. But vitally, you don't make that the Doctor. You don't mess with what everyone else has been happy to accept since the late 60s, that the Doctor is from this Time Lord society, and from, what, 73-ish, we've known it as Gallifrey. You just don't mess with that. You don't change things. But in terms of adding things, adding some lore that doesn't change anything that came before, like where regeneration came from, that's brilliant. Does the Doctor meet this original alien? Is it more that the Doctor becomes repulsed at what her people did and what's in her body because of these awful experiments? It's a whole other reason for her to go on the run from the Time Lords and not want to help them. But instead, Chibnall just blows them up and makes the Doctor the Timeless Child. You know, like the most boring, cliched route you could take. Extraordinary. It's like he had this great idea, but he just didn't stop himself, Dave.
I want to watch your episode, Rob.
Really?
I think that would actually be a really cool and quite dramatic episode, just to sort of discover that. And I could see Jodie Whittaker and Chasha Dhawan delivering that really, really well. I like that you didn't go down the path of, we'll just not make that episode.
No.
You've actually taken the idea and made it work, and I really like that.
yeah, it doesn't change anything. That's the vital thing, but it does add something new and dark and whoa.
Wow, I like that. I like that a lot.
Thank you very much.
So, Rob, we've done a lot of time meddling now. We've changed 10 points in the show's history. The big takeaway that I got out of this, apart from it being quite a fun exercise that I've really enjoyed and I hope the listeners have enjoyed, is it just helped me appreciate that a little bit more, how often the show's producers and production team and the like have made very smart, very shrewd decisions that have kept the show going and kept the show on the rails. And particularly once you get past the mid-70s, how easy it would be to not change much and result in a lot less Doctor Who.
Yeah, I always think of that 2013 quote from Moffat about going to write the 50th anniversary special and not even having the Doctor contracted for it. Wild things happen behind the scenes sometimes, and the production teams have to deal with some pretty crazy moments. And the fact that the show just keeps going and going is testament to that, even if we do have year and a half wait sometimes, even if we have this and that. And, you know, these decisions get made for better or worse. Sometimes they could have worked out better, as we've shown tonight. Sometimes they could have worked out disastrously, as we've shown tonight. It's a fascinating topic, Dave.
Yeah, so listeners, please let us know what you think. What ideas have you had? Did you enjoy this topic? Do you want us to see us do it again one day? Do you think that it's all a bit of a fantasy and we should just never touch this again? Let us know, and we'll be fascinated to hear from you. We have heard, though, from a couple of listeners, and I'm going to start with an email from Doc Hume of the Diddly Dumb podcast, who has said via email, "Sliding doors moment in Doctor Who history. We know that until 1984, the BBC had an MI5 intelligence officer squirreled away in an office at Broadcasting House, vetting the appointment of potential political subversives to the corporation. So let's imagine that, instead of regularly expelling him for thought crime, the Communist Party of Great Britain had welcomed Malcolm Hulk with open arms and even elected him as their president. There's no way that the BBC would have been allowed to employ him. This would have given us a Hulk-less Doctor Who, so no invasion of the dinosaurs, which might have meant that Mark Yates had longer to recover from his experiences in the Green Death. Then he wouldn't have been sacked from UNIT. Then in Mordred Undead, the Brig might have told the Doctor that Mike was running UNIT now. And if he'd had more of his old friends hanging around at UNIT HQ, maybe Benton wouldn't have quit. Then, without the dead weight of Benton, just imagine how successful the UK second-hand car industry could have been. Maybe so successful that it could have carried the British economy through the aftermath of Brexit. In the words of Benjamin Franklin, and all for the want of a Communist Party membership." That's very funny, Doc. I really like that.
Very enjoyable. And look, some of it, though, is quite serious. You know, what would if Hulk never wrote for Doctor Who? There's the premise. Yeah, even just in terms of what would have happened to Mike Yates. Wow.
Look, as you know, Rob, Malcolm Hulk is my favourite writer, and to channel the master, a cosmos without Malcolm Hulk scarcely bears thinking about.
Very good.
And you have an email as well, Rob.
Yes, Peter Dedman has written us an email. Hello, Peter. He says, "Hi, guys. I'm a bit behind on commenting, so feel free to cut as needed." Well, I'm not going to cut, Peter. I'm going to read the whole bloody thing. "Regarding Doctor Who, I really enjoyed your Series 10 discussion. For me, it was the first time I really liked Capaldi in the role. In the first two seasons, he was an unlikable jerk most of the time, saddled with irritating side characters and bad stories. With the exception of the three Monk episodes, I felt pretty much all of Series 10 was great, up there with my favourites from all of New Who. For Tearjerkers," and that was one of our Listmaker episodes, if you've not heard it, dear listeners, "really, the only time Doctor Who has got me emotional was Vincent and the Doctor. Most other times, I am either unaffected by it or annoyed at the manipulative attempts to prod an emotion out of me."
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sounds like you, Dave, yeah. "For Star Wars and your prequel reviews, I find it hard to say whether I like The Phantom Menace or Attack of the Clones more. On the one hand, Phantom Menace has more silliness, like Jar Jar, but Attack of the Clones has an overly complex storyline when it should be simple. One point I thought at the time made sense was Master Sifo Dyas was simply a fictional Jedi, made up by Darth Sidious, since all the names are so familiar. Turns out Sifo Dyas was actually a Jedi who placed this order and then got murdered. Regardless, I like Revenge of the Sith a lot, even if I feel it should have been over two movies, and we started with Attack of the Clones. Keep up the good work, guys. From Peter.
Well, Peter, thank you for that email and that excellent summary of what we've been producing over the last month. If any of that intrigued you, please go check it out.
Yeah, it's all on the feed.
And I think that Vincent and the Doctor did get a mention in the list makers.
It did, it did. And also talking Star Wars and Sifo Dyas, I went into him a little on our chat on Attack of the Clones.
You did, absolutely. And our chat on Revenge of the Sith will be out later in April.
Yes.
So, Rob, we're getting near the end of our show, but first a quick what have we been watching. I did in the last month finish Masters of the Air, which is over on Apple TV. I thought this was an excellent series. It had a few detractors. Some British viewers have been a bit upset by the way the British have been portrayed in that, and I do sort of understand that it is very American-focused, but deliberately so. And some people I've seen have been sort of very negative about the sameness of it or the relentlessness of it, but I kind of saw that as part of the wonder of the show, because it's about these American air crew doing bombing raids over Europe in World War II. And the idea that you go and do a bombing raid over Germany in basically a tin can, and you survive that, and then they say, right, 2 days later, you're going up again and doing it all over again. That's part of just what that experience was. And I just thought this was a very good show in just giving us this idea of what this relentless, horrific experience must have been like for this air crew. And even when some of them end up in prisoner of war camps, it's not the jolly sort of, well, now you're in a prisoner of war camp, everything's over for you. It's the stress of that. It's the terror of what could happen next. And I think they just got that terror of being air crew in World War II absolutely right. And that really made it for me, as somebody who was in the Air Force and had two grandfathers who flew air crew in World War II, I thought it really hit home. It was just a really good series. Great cast. Austin Butler's really, really good in it. Shooty Gatwa turns up, but this is obviously pre-fame Shooty Gatwa, because again, like Barbie, he has about two lines across two episodes. So he is there. I think the only reason he made in the title sequence because they're like, oh, everyone's going to want to know Shooty Gatwa now, even though he's a very, very minor character. But look, not everyone's loved it, but I have loved it. The very last season of Young Royals also dropped a couple of weeks ago. That's been a bit of a guilty pleasure for me. I've really enjoyed it. But I wanted to mention it here particularly because the way they dropped the last series was interesting. They said after season two, we're going to do a third series, but it'll be three and a half. This will be the end of the show, the end of the story. So we're going to do one more six-episode season. It'll come out next year. And then a couple of months ago, they said, get excited. The new series three of Young Royals is coming. It's the last one ever. Episodes 1 to 5... will drop on this date. A week later, episode 6 will drop. So what they did was let all the fans watch the first 5 episodes over the course of a week. Some will have binged in one day, others would have taken the full week to do it. But it meant that everybody who was watching the show got to watch the final episode on the same day. And I thought that was a really interesting approach to streaming, because we've all had those things, you know, Stranger Things is the classic example where somebody finishes a season, you're like, oh, have you seen it yet? No, only up to episode 4. Well, tell me when you get up to episode 6. Yeah. This allowed everybody to see the finale at the same time, regardless of how long they took to watch the first 5. And I wonder if that's a model that Netflix and others are going to pick up.
Well, that's very interesting, because your Young Royals being your guilty pleasure is my Elite being my guilty pleasure.
Very, very much so, yes.
And that is going to end this year with the final season, and that is on Netflix. So I wonder if they'll do something similar.
Ooh, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the series start to do this. Just hold the finale off for a week so it can be more of that event moment.
Yeah, and as for Masters of the Air, I'm very looking forward to seeing that. I will get on an Apple TV subscription one day. I just haven't yet. I'm very interested in that. I loved Band of Brothers. I thought The Pacific was pretty good. And it comes from the same sort of production team. So I'm very excited about that. And I'm very interested in the air war in Europe in general too.
And part of the Pacific was filmed at my school.
Was it really?
It really was.
Great. Interesting though, you say the British didn't like their portrayal in Masters of the Air. The way Australians are sort of portrayed in the Pacific was a little off too.
Yes, I think that's a, I mean, that's a debate that's been going back since Hollywood started making World War II movies in the 50s. So yeah. Nothing's changed there.
Yeah. As for me, I've been all over the place, Dave. Old 80s movies like Heathers and The Outsiders, Morons from Outer Space with Mel Smith and Chris Rees-Jones, right through to newer movies like The Monuments Men, which I really enjoyed, you know, being a World War II movie that isn't all about fighting and battles, even though I like films that are about fighting and battles, via 90s movies like Gross Point Blank. I've been on fire with movies, but one thing I've been hitting hard of late on Netflix is doco-type stuff like The Program, which is about this harrowing secondary school for unruly children. The only problem is a bunch of normal, not-so-unruly children get sent there, and they just can't understand why their parents are sending them into this torturous place because the parents don't know how bad this place is. This is all true story. I watched Waco, American Apocalypse, which covers an event, obviously the Waco siege, that happened during my first year of uni. So I have very adult memories of it. I remember it well. But the added insight of people talking from both sides of the coin, you've got Branch Davidians talking about what it was like to be inside there with David Koresh and with the FBI shooting at them. And you've got people talking about what it was like to assault the compound and all of that. All of that's new to me. It's just eye-opening stuff. And finally, Homicide New York, which is lots of New York detectives talking about their big, harrowing cases. Just absolutely fascinating to hear them speak about how they do police work. Primarily, some awful, awful crimes happened as well. So I've been doing a lot of crimey documentary type stuff.
Fantastic. Now, there's a lot to watch at the moment. I should also mention I saw Dune 2 in the cinema. It is spectacular. Mm. It is intelligent, worthy science fiction. And if you're sitting there thinking, oh, maybe I'll wait for the streaming, do yourself a favour and see this movie in the cinema.
Yeah, it's made for it.
It absolutely is. So that's our episode for this month. Rob, what are we going to do next month?
Dave, a long time ago, I want to say a year ago, maybe longer, you said to me, have you ever read Who Killed Kennedy? And I think it's gone from there.
Yes, so we are going to be doing an episode on the 90s standalone novel. It wasn't part of the NAs, it wasn't part of the MAs, it was just this random novel that Virgin put out called Who Killed Kennedy. It's one of my favourite books. I hope you enjoyed it as well, Rob. Listeners, as always when we do these books, we will drop a mini episode a couple of days early where we will do a bit of a plot summary. So if you want to read it yourself before the episode comes out, you've got a month to do it. If you just want to listen to our plot summary a couple of days before, we'll have one of those as well so that everyone will know what we're talking about. But yes, a quite famous, I think it's fair to say, well-regarded book. I'm really looking forward to reading this again and having a chat about it.
Pretty expensive one to buy if you're a listener saying, oh, I'll just go ahead and grab a copy on eBay. Maybe rethink that idea.
Yes, but there are, I believe, online copies floating about if you know where to look.
Yes.
So that's it for next month. I've had fun, Rob, but it's time to go and get into the Easter weekend.
It is. Happy Easter, Dave.
Happy Easter, Rob, and happy Easter to all of you at home. And on that note, I've been Dave.
I've been Rob.
And we'll speak again soon.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to
The Doctor Who Show with Rob and Dave.
Find us online by searching for
The Doctor Who Show.
We also love it when you write in. Drop us a line anytime at hello@thedwshow.net.